I'm Leonard Lopate. Welcome to my show. The aftermath of Hurricane Katrina has exposed harsh inequities in New Orleans. On this week's Underreported, we'll take a look into what some call environmental racism and why America's minorities and poor are more likely to suffer from pollution and natural disasters than affluent Americans. Joining me now are Melissa Checker, author of Polluted Promises, Environmental Racism and the Search for Justice in a Southern Town. Also, Majora Carter, a MacArthur Fellow and founder of the organization Sustainable South Bronx. Welcome to my show.
Thank you.
Melissa, your book focuses on the neighborhood of Hyde Park in Augusta, Georgia. What brought you there?
Well, I was interested in looking at in a community that had been organizing for environmental justice for some time in the South, which was really the nexus of a lot of civil rights activism. And at the time, environmental justice was being referred to as the civil rights of the new millennium. And so I really kind of wanted to go down there, and that's where a lot of environmental justice activism has been centered.
What environmental and health issues have residents been struggling with there? And is it worse than any number of other American neighborhoods?
Well, certainly the problems in the community that I worked with in Hyde Park are very common in a lot of communities across the country. The fact that the people that live there are mostly low income and are about 99% African American is also significant. And we do find, or I argue in my book, that race is usually a fairly good indicator of whether a community is going to host toxic sites.
Mm-hmm. What's the demographic makeup of Augusta?
Augusta itself is about 60% black.
So this is not a unique neighborhood, or this is the poor black neighborhood?
This is definitely the poor black neighborhood. They say that they live on they're on the other side of the tracks, and actually two railroad tracks border the neighborhood. And they've also, at one time, they were surrounded by 9 polluting industries. So they describe themselves as, they describe their neighborhood as a toxic donut, and they would be the hole in the middle of the toxic donut.
And those polluting industries, are most of them still there, or have they left the way so many other industries have left?
Most of them are still there. One of them closed down, a wood preserving factory, and that factory was... the community sued that company for contaminating them. But there are other industries that are still there. There's a power plant still there, an industrial ceramics plant, a brickyard, several gas stations and auto repair shops, which a lot of people don't know but are also very toxic.
Do they bear the sole responsibility for the polluted situation there?
Well, it's very difficult to determine who's responsible because there are so many industries. And so it's been very hard to pinpoint exactly where the chemicals are coming from. I should mention, too, there was an enormous junkyard that actually butted up against people's backyards. And that junkyard has been cleared off since I did my research.
Majora, your work has focused on the South Bronx. Are there similarities between what's happened in Augusta and what's currently happening in the South Bronx?
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, Melissa, as Melissa stated earlier, this is not unique to any of our neighborhoods. I mean, an environmental justice community up here looks very similar. Up here, for example, we've got just in a mile radius, like 15 waste facilities, 4 power plants, a sewage treatment plant, a sewage sludge pelletizing plant, and about 60,000 diesel truck trips coming through the neighborhood a week. And you're also dealing with a population that's probably about 95% of color, Latino and Black American. And yes, it usually is politically expedient, to cite these kind of facilities in a community, that essentially often doesn't really vote, where there's not the kind of like economic, resources to push them out. So the word, the phrase NIMBY, not in my backyard, is not something that most community environmental justice communities, unfortunately, can actually use because our backyard is already, filled with all of these things.
So environmental activists face pretty much the same challenges, whether it involves a border town in Texas or an Indian reservation or a large urban area like New York City?
I absolutely believe so. The any moment, and it is, I believe, a civil rights issue, you know, of the 21st century as well, because if you are taking a group that was considered powerless and using that, you know, to the advantage for economic or political interests, then absolutely it is a major problem, and it's one that environmental justice activists around the country are, you know, starting to understand that there are aspects and things that they can actually do on their own.
Do you think that the way environmental justice issues are dealt with are different in large urban areas like New York? Are people more less likely to organize, for example?
No, I think that the difference is as soon as people start understanding that there are other options, you know, for their communities and actually start thinking about planning, whether it's urban or rural, and that there are different ways to actually do business in their own communities, and that they're the folks that actually do the site, the regulatory agencies really do need to be accountable, you know, for the public health and welfare and economic development for all of its constituents and not just for ones that are actually usually wealthier and in many cases whiter. That's when people start to become empowered and start to rethinking the ideas of what their own communities can and should look like, and that would part start putting their resources together. And that's what's happened, you know, in citywide around in New York City, quite frankly, and they've started specifically around solid waste management and how come low-income communities of color around the city were the ones that handled about 95% of the city's, you know, commercial and residential waste.
Well, recently we looked into the issue in Newtown Creek, where mm-hmm. there is the largest oil spill in North America, and it's only recently that people have mobilized to fight it. Mm-hmm. People have been living in the Greenpoint area affected for 60 years
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
The smells are bad. They know there's something wrong, but they felt powerless, and city government has refused to do much
mm-hmm.
about it.
If I can say, Leonard, one thing that I found, I did some research for my master's degree in Greenpoint, Williamsburg in Brooklyn, and they were organizing to oppose an incinerator there, mm-hmm. the people of the community. And the similarities I found between the ways that they organized and the ways that they had come to awareness of the issue were incredibly similar to what I found in Hyde Park.
Mm-hmm. Well, Majora, you grew up in the South Bronx, didn't
mm-hmm.
you?
Yes.
Were people talking about quality of life issues at that time?
No, not at all. Early on, I mean, I grew up also when the South Bronx was actually considered the poster child for urban blight. This is when huge waves of banking, manufacturing, business disinvestment happened. And so a lot of the buildings here that were actually burned by landlords for their insurance money. So if we were that, I mean, we were not a one-issue community. The last thing people were thinking about were environmental issues.
And they weren't talking about asthma or lead poisoning.
That came later when many of the warehouses that were abandoned were taken over by garbage interests. And we realized, and many people realized, that there was a link between the waste facilities in the community and the rise in asthma in the neighborhood.
Well, your organization recently was involved in a battle over a plan for a solid waste management
mm-hmm.
plant to process 40% of the city's garbage at a facility at the Hunts Point waterfront.
Right.
Did you succeed in your fight?
Yes, we did. But that, even though that facility was in Hunts Point, it really became a rallying point for all environmental justice communities around the city, because we realized that although it was Hunts Point, the policies that they were trying to push would have affected environmental justice communities all around the city.
But Hunts Point is where most of our food is now distributed from.
80% of the produce.
Did anybody understand that might actually affect the food that's there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's been happening. I mean, we've had the world's largest food distribution center for the past 3 years at this point.
And now the Fulton Fish Market has moved down
mm-hmm.
there as well.
Absolutely. And so these are the kind of things that we certainly like to bring up, you know, in terms of like the region's food supply, you know, in such close proximity to its waste. And we actually have had some decent results in terms of the kind of advocacy that we've been doing in terms of recognizing that there needs to be a lot more planning, you know, in terms of creating better opportunities, you know, so that traffic can move through the neighborhoods easily, so that waste is not considered, you know, like an appropriate neighbor, you know, to the largest food distribution center in the world at this point. However, but again, that's all part of like a much more regional approach to planning that really has not been taken into account, you know, in urban areas and certainly not in New York City.
I'm talking with Majora Carter, who's the founder of the organization Sustainable South Bronx, and Melissa Checker, who has written a book called Polluted Promises, Environmental Racism and the Search for Justice in a Southern Town. So, Melissa, how would you define environmental racism? What kind of environmental patterns have emerged over the years?
Well, I think environmental racism is, the way that I define it, it involves a complex set of factors. So it's not necessarily that one factory or one industry says, you know, I don't like those people, so I'm going to dump in their backyard. But there are a host of things and of systems of discrimination in our society that lead to this. So, for example, we know that the way that the property values that people of color, the land that they live on, the property is lower valued, and that they're less likely to get mortgage loans and home improvement loans. These are most often allocated to white neighborhoods, partly because of the property values.
Well, is this a matter of race or a matter of class?
Well, I think first of all, I think that race and class are really linked in our society, and so it's sometimes very hard to delink race and economics. But I think what's going on is that there have been many studies done where housing, say real estate agents, if they see a family of color, they're going to steer them into a black neighborhood, and that blacks are denied mortgages at twice the rate of whites. And so some of that is more about race, but it's also very tied to economics. But when we look overall at national studies that show where toxic industry is located, we find that race is actually a better predictor than class. So to kind of put that much more simply, if there's a toxic waste site, it's more likely to go in a middle-income black neighborhood than it would be to go in a lower-income white neighborhood. Not that low-income white neighborhoods don't also host a lot of toxic facilities, but we do find that race is more of a predictor.
And the civil rights movement had nothing to do with turning this around? Was this even an issue during the 60s and 70s when there was the most activism?
No, I think what happened, unfortunately, was that environmentalism was really seen as a kind of white middle class issue, and that it was seemed to be more about sort of preservation and conservation. And both movements were sort of heating up at the same time, mm-hmm. and environmentalism ended up really drawing a lot of attention and resources. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, the two movements ended up kind of at odds right there in the early 1970s. And then once environmentalists, again, a lot of whom early on were white and middle class, were able to change some environmental regulations, they were then able to keep a lot of these things out of their own backyards.
Right.
And, of course, they had to go somewhere, so they ended up going into the backyards of people of color.
Right.
So the two movements have kind of not been seen as coming together until around the mid to late 1980s, when people of color realized that the environment was an issue for them too.
Yeah. Okay,
we have to take a little break here. We'll come back to all of this. My guests are Melissa Checker, whose book is Polluted Promises, Environmental Racism and the Search for Justice in a Southern Town. In this case, we're talking about the Hyde Park neighborhood in Augusta, Georgia. And Majora Carter, who is the founder of the organization Sustainable South Bronx. Stay with us for more. We're back with Majora Carter, who is the founder of the organization Sustainable South Bronx, and with Melissa Checker, author of Polluted Promises, Environmental Racism and the Search for Justice in a Southern Town. That's from NYU Press. We're talking about what some are calling environmental racism on today's Underreported. So how much, we're talking about the odd clash between environmentalists and people concerned with environmental justice. How much do consumer patterns play into the inequalities? I know affluent people consume more and they are creating more pollution and waste, Is that something that they are unwittingly dumping on poor areas?
Yeah. Well, I think, from what I know, from the activists I know, the environmental justice activists I know, what their main goal is not to redistribute toxic burdens necessarily. They would prefer that nobody have to host these toxic burdens. So they're looking at more prevention strategies. So yes, looking at consumerism and why do we produce so much waste and how can we reduce the amount of waste that we produce? Because I think it is very easy for people to not think about where it's going, especially
yes,
if it's not going in their yard.
Right, but in a place as highly urbanized as New York City, we do have to recognize that, like for example, the solid waste issues in New York City, Manhattan wasn't handling any of its own waste at all. But, neighborhoods like the South Bronx, was. And so we really did have to say, if you produce, it is about sharing the burdens as well as the wealth. And so we do have to acknowledge that. And so for a large part of it is absolutely, dealing with things such as waste reduction and energy conservation, et cetera. But we also all have to be responsible, as well as understanding that certain communities have felt the burden and that is not fair and something that we have to deal with. And if it means that, people in wealthier communities are going to have to handle some of their own stuff, then yes, that is the case, because the argument that there is no longer or that no one is going to deal with it is just not something that makes any kind of sense anymore, because it isn't true. We're all going to have to handle it if we're going to responsibly live on this planet.
But when there was a waste management plant put into Manhattan, it was put into Harlem, wasn't it? Although it turns out to be one of the better ones in the city. Others have been proposed for the Brooklyn waterfront, again, poor neighborhoods.
Well, no. What we've actually done as part of the Organization for Waterfront Neighborhoods is actually work with the city at this point. It almost didn't pass because there were members of the New York City Council that really didn't want, part of their own communities to deal with the solid waste that they themselves produce, in particular the Upper East Side. But the bottom line is, what we're trying to do is create a more equitable plan that actually does recognize that all communities have to deal with the burdens that they create. And now we actually have a plan where actually that is, we're working on a plan. It's not completely done yet at all. But the bottom line is, it is an open acknowledgement, of the fact that some communities, all environmental justice communities, have unfortunately borne this burden for much longer than they should have.
But Majora, one of the other issues the both of you talk about is creating open spaces.
Absolutely.
How can that be a priority when there are so many social and economic issues involved?
In order to build a healthy and livable community, you have to deal with all of those aspects, whether it's like municipal waste services or the development of open space, so that communities can feel as though they actually have places where they can actually call communities. There are plenty of examples around the world where these things are actually put into a place in a strategically planned area that allows the development for all of those things without necessarily being like huge, enormous burdens on anybody. And what we've really challenged, is the kind of like really awful nature of urban planning in New York City that actually takes into account the kind of sustainable development planning that we've seen happen around the world. And what we're trying to do right now, we're working on building greenways. We're working on job development programs that actually train people in the art of urban ecological restoration so that the community members themselves can actually be a part of its own development. We're looking at economics, community economics, as a way to support the development of all of our livelihoods, both not just the public health women, not just the ones that happens in our pocketbooks, but also how do you create a real livable community that actually meets people's needs?
Well, how has the city responded to that request?
The city's actually worked with us on a bunch of levels. We've actually worked with the city and our Bronx Borough President's Office to create a Hunts Point vision plan for what are the kinds of things that we want to see in a community, and they've actually been responsive. Now, unfortunately, it's just in a plan phase, but we have been very encouraged by the level of interest that the city's had in terms of looking at our communities, not just as the places where you put things that the wealthy neighborhoods of the city doesn't want to deal with, but actually helping to create in essence, the kind of livable community that we all want to live in. You know, and poor communities absolutely need that too. And in addition to opportunities, so that our communities don't stay so poor. That's why the kind of economic developments that we're trying to encourage here, you know, actually are living wage but don't degrade the environment. Unfortunately, like the ones that are here right now.
Melissa, has the municipal government of Augusta, Georgia, been responsive?
Well, they.
I guess not.
Well, they respond. It seems to go in cycles. And so, for example, the community, the Masters golf tournament takes place in Augusta every year. And during one of those years, I think it was in 1994, the community staged an enormous protest that, you know, really captured a lot of attention because it was during Masters Week. And right after that, the government made some promises to help them out. And they have been somewhat helpful. It just seems to kind of go a little bit in waves. Right now, they are making some very, they are really talking about taking some very serious steps towards investigating the options for relocation, which would be a really fantastic thing, and it's what a lot of residents really want. And so they're supposed to be, there's a new election happening, there's a runoff going on as we speak, and depending on the outcome of that runoff, there may be a task force created to relocate the community. But it's been very surprising because when things are died down, for example, in 2002, a new landfill was permitted for this neighborhood, and that was after these huge protests and after they'd gotten attention from the government and from the press. They still allowed a landfill, and that kind of happens every couple years. It seems to kind of, they get some attention, then it dies down, and then somebody tries to sneak in a landfill or something.
Well, we were told on the show when we were talking about Newtown Creek that protesters were told by the Bloomberg administration that if New York had won the Olympics, Newtown Creek's cleanup would have been speeded up. So I guess it's all our fault.
Right.
So I guess we need to have more golf tournaments and Olympics, and then maybe some of these things will be addressed. My guests are Melissa Checker, who's written Polluted Promises, Environmental Racism, and the Search for Justice in a Southern Town. It's from NYU Press. And Majora Carter, who is the founder of the organization Sustainable South Bronx. We are talking about environmental racism on today's Underreported here on WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Is it hard to make the case when you go to court because health effects take a long time to show up, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this has been a very difficult problem. In Hyde Park, they have found a number of chemicals, and they found in certain places some very high levels of those chemicals, and people are reporting illnesses, but it's incredibly hard to make the connection between those contaminants and those illnesses. And there are a whole number of reasons. One thing is we know very little about cumulative effects. So usually you kind of measure for how much arsenic is there, and then you look for the diseases that arsenic causes. But what happens when arsenic interacts with lead, interacts with PCBs? We don't really know very much about what happens there, and we don't know what levels are safe in the case of interactions like that.
Well, Majora, in the case of the South Bronx, it has some of the highest levels of asthma in the country, and people have made a direct connection between asthma and the environment. Has that case been made in the courts?
We were actually able to prove cumulative impacts, actually. Like, after we saw a rise in asthma rates after 1987, which is when the large groups of waste facilities started locating here, when the sewage sludge pelletizing plant started coming here, when we realized there was a huge increase in diesel truck traffic, and that's when the asthma rate started rising, and people made that connection. And the way we were able to one of the reasons why we were able to beat back one of the larger waste facilities that wanted to come here is because we challenged them, you know, on cumulative impacts. Like, you know what, you're trying to, you know, look at your facility in isolation, but what about the other 15 that are here? And the fact that each one of them, you know, adds insult to injury. So No, I mean, yes, so we have absolutely been able to show that. And at this point, you cannot walk around this neighborhood and not, people will tell you in a minute that, yes, of course, like the reason why my kids have asthma is because of all this pollution in the neighborhood.
Melissa, can you tell us about the Hyde Park, Augusta, Georgia case, Jordan et al. Versus Southern Wood et al.?
Yes. Well, what happened in this case was the Southern Wood is a wood, or was a wood preserving factory, and it was located nearby Hyde Park. And there was a predominantly white neighborhood that was adjacent to the wood preserving factory. And the factory closed in the early 1990s because it needed to do some significant cleanup, and it felt that it could do that cleanup better if it closed down. Now, the white neighborhood filed a lawsuit and received some compensation in 1991, but the people in Hyde Park, again, who are African-American, weren't offered anything. They weren't asked to be part of the lawsuit. They were kind of completely left out of it. And when they heard about it, they filed their own suit because there are ditches. Although the white neighborhood was slightly closer to the wood preserving factory, there are ditches that run directly from it into Hyde Park. Hyde Park, of course, because it's a very low, because it was affordable for these people that lived there who were former sharecroppers, is a floodplain. And so it would, you know, the ditches would run through, but they would flood in heavy rains. And so it seemed fairly clear to the residents that if one neighborhood had possibility of contamination, mm-hmm. then theirs did too.
Right.
Unfortunately, however, that they filed their lawsuit in 1991, and there's still it is still unresolved.
Well, some people argue that all of this is not a matter of race, but choice. For example, Hunts Point has been New York's industrial center for years, and people still choose to live there. How do you respond to that, Majora?
I'd say poverty, poverty, poverty. You know, this is also one of the poorest congressional districts in the country. People often don't have a choice.
They can't leave, even if they are aware that there are environmental hazards in their neighborhood?
New York real estate is one of some of the highest in the country. And, that is just one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard. And, unfortunately, people still say it.
Well, I've also read that the South Bronx has some of the worst nutritional
mm-hmm.
standards, and yet we're talking about the food center
right.
of the New York area.
Absolutely. You know, it's harder to get a good apple in this neighborhood than it is. You can find all the fast food in the world you want, and that, I think, is just as deliberate as well. You know, how we're being targeted is also an issue as well. So, yes, absolutely.
Hurricane Katrina made many people aware of inequalities. Do you think that it is a major turning point?
I think it just laid bare, you know, this country's racism and classism and exposed it in a way that people weren't necessarily, had no idea. But what I hope actually comes from it, you know, are the creation of policies that actually help prevent stuff like that from happening.
Do you think it will encourage underprivileged people in other communities to speak out?
I think it has on a certain level, and I think what it did for me personally, for many of my colleagues, was just make it much more urgent, you know, the work that we're doing, like actually figuring out not just like how do you put a Band-Aid, you know, on a levee, so to speak, but how do you create systems that actually support the growth and development of low-income people and people of color in our own communities that actually provide them with real means for advancing themselves. I mean, I'm not talking, you know, a welfare system that actually keeps people dependent on it, but one that actually supports their development, and there needs to be a lot more thought put into it than just that.
Melissa, you've moved on to Memphis, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
What are you doing there?
I'm teaching at the University of Memphis, and I have also been working with a community that is the community surrounds a former U.S. Military Defense Depot.
So there are problems in Memphis as well. Surprise,
yes,
surprise.
There are definitely problems in Memphis. And one of the things, if I can quickly add, with the nutrition issue is that the people I work with, both in Memphis and in Georgia, they had grown elaborate gardens. They had all come from farming families. Mm-hmm. And when they found out their neighborhoods were contaminated, they had to let those gardens die. Mm-hmm. And that just completely erased their access to fresh produce because you know, the grocery stores in their neighborhoods don't carry such great produce, and it's very expensive, and their nutrition really diminished after that. And so this is a connection that a lot of people don't necessarily make.
Majoria, haven't you encouraged people to develop rooftop gardens?
Well, that is the next stage. We actually are doing green roofs, you know, as a stormwater management, energy efficient task force, but we're now investigating the possibility of actually creating roof gardens so that people can actually do that, because there's not much space to do community gardens too much, you know, in our neighborhoods, and not enough on the scale to feed that many people.
And you might not want to use that soil.
Also.
And what about along the waterfront, the Bronx River? Mm-hmm. Is that a good place to develop any gardens?
No, that would be more about actually creating more activity, more resources for people to engage in physical activity. We're actually working on developing a greenway that will go all the way around the South Bronx waterfront so that people can actually exercise safely. Because even the fact that if you want to go for a jog or a quick walk in the neighborhood, you do that at the risk to your life, because there are so many truck traffic issues around here as well.
I want to thank you both so much for participating in Underreported today. I've been talking with Majora Carter, who's a MacArthur Fellow and a founder of the organization Sustainable South Bronx, and Melissa Checker, whose book, Polluted Promises, Environmental Racism and the Search for Justice in a Southern Town, is published by NYU Press. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.